the thought that possibly that God would be as pleased and would benefit from what we do today as we are is a great thought. We clearly see the blessing of being here, of seeing others who care about God and who have faith in Jesus Christ and they want to worship and serve Him, and that we are so blessed and reminded of those blessings because of all that's been said and done today. It's such a blessing to us, and may in some small way it please God what we do. And we are grateful for those who have joined us for these activities today. Humans appear to have always had a real appetite for superheroes. A lot of civilizations have had stories about such individuals who have abilities and powers beyond the normal, and they are inspirational. From Hercules and Atlas of Greek mythology to Superman and Spider-Man of the 20th century America, people want to find someone who's greater than they are and admire and draw comfort from the belief that this mighty one might just arrive at the right time to save them from peril. The common motif in any superhero story, though, is not just about his powers or her powers. Oftentimes, the real tension and real dilemma in the superhero narrative has to do with the moral issues attached to their use of those powers. Will the possession of extreme, even absolute power, corrupt the hero? Will the hero use his or her power for their own benefit and not for the good of other people? Will the hero save his sweetheart or save the world? Will such power be applied in such a way that the hero's motives will be pure and his actions just? Human beings have always had superhero narratives because they're longing for one. That's why. So for that longing, I offer for your consideration Jesus. However, he's in a different category than all those others. Here's just a quick list. First of all, his story is couched in historical documents. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John do not read like myths. They're laced with detailed and accurate historical information and cultural references. For most of the Greek heroes, it's hard to source who penned their story. Over time, the stories sort of evolved and were added to and changed by different people. They built up over time through various writers. And we know who made up the story of Spider-Man. It was greatly the creation of a man by the name of Stan Lee. But not so with Jesus. We have historical documents, by any measurement of what a historical document is, and they claim to be records of what really happened. Second of all, though Jesus is thoroughly human, he took on human flesh, there is no weakness that exists that can lead to his demise. There's no exposed heel like with Achilles. There is no kryptonite. Okay, make sure I get that right, because I know there's going to be somebody who will correct me on that, some Superman expert. There is no kryptonite when it comes to Jesus. You may think, well, isn't part of the central story of Jesus him dying? Yes, it was. All on purpose. Jesus said himself in John 10, verse 17 and 18, I lay down my life that I may take it up again. No one takes it from me. But I lay it down and I have authority to take it up again. And thirdly, Jesus did not perform supernatural acts for shallow earthly reasons, but for grander eternal ones. The two main actions of Jesus, and you see that as if you've been reading in the Gospel of Luke, in the congregational readings, and you'll see the same thing in Matthew and John and Mark. The two main actions of Jesus were teaching and doing miracles. That's the chunk of the material of the Gospels, his teaching and him doing miracles. And his supernatural feats were not merely to impress people. There are several occasions in which people wanted him to do that just for the effect of a supernatural feat, and he wouldn't do it. They had purpose. And it was connected to his identity and connected to what he taught. Jesus says this about that purpose in John chapter 10 and in verse 37. He says, because he knows some are resisting what he's saying, he says, if I am not doing the works of my Father, then do not believe me. But if I do them, even though you don't believe me, in other words, you don't like what I'm saying, you don't believe my words, even though you don't believe me, believe the works, that you may know and understand that the Father is in me and I in the Father. His words and his actions, which includes his miraculous deeds, were to prove that he was God the Son, sent from the Father for the purpose of revealing the Father to us and connecting us to the Father. He would be the link between God and humans, and his supernatural acts confirm that. In his work, even his physical miracles with people were for spiritual ends and eternal ends, to bring us to God in eternal life with God. So today we turn our attention to one of those supernatural acts in one of our recent readings in Luke chapter 7. You can turn there with me. And this is part of our congregational focus this year. We wish to see Jesus. We're reading now in the Gospel of Luke, and then we'll read some letters after Luke, and then we'll go back and read in Matthew, and we'll circulate all through the four Gospels with letters in the New Testament to complement that. Last week we noted that even though January and February is a little bit off because of other activities, monthly I'll have a sermon about some miracle of Jesus or feat of Jesus, and then a lesson about some characteristic, some attribute of Jesus. So today we're going to look at a very dramatic and mighty act. So if we're going to look at a miracle, going to look at miracles, why not start with a humdinger? And that's in Luke chapter 7. In Luke chapter 7, start with me in verse 11. Soon afterward, he went to a town called Nain. Jesus has been up around Galilee, the Sea of Galilee. This is the region generally from which he was from, okay? And he has been up in this northwestern Galilean area in a place called Capernaum. And he's just healed the servant of a centurion. And there's quite a stir about this. Now, he migrates southward down to this place called Nain, which is not very far from Nazareth, which is where he was raised. So this is familiar territory for him. And he's just performed a miracle, and he's coming here, and look who's with him. The end of verse 11, it says, and his disciples and a great crowd went with him. So Jesus had a collection of disciples who were with him on a regular basis. We know of the disciples, the 12 apostles, were with him really full time. But there was a collection of followers that were with him on a regular basis. But also we're told that there were the crowds. A crowd was with him. Either these are locals who have heard about him coming their way, and they go out and they look for him and they find him. We see occasions of that. Or there's some people who are following him place to place. We see some examples of that. For sure, these crowds that were going with Jesus, especially in conjunction to miracles, they were excited. They were jubilant. They were abuzz. And this crowd that's abuzz and walking with Jesus encounter another crowd. In verse 12. And these two crowds meet. As he drew near the gate of the town, behold, a man who had died was being carried out, the only son of his mother, and she was a widow. And a considerable crowd from the town was with her. Could the crowd that Jesus was with encounter a crowd coming out of the town whose mood was different, more different than what they were? One was all excited to be with Jesus. The other one are participating in, well, the human tragedy, death. He's a man who died evidently before his expected time. His mother was still living, and later in this text, Jesus actually calls him young man. What a tragedy. I remember many, many, many years ago, an older lady who was a very faithful follower of Christ, whose daughter, and she was a faithful Christian, died of cancer, and she expressed, "There's no pain like bearing a child." This woman knew that pain. But we're told in this very succinct text that she was a widow, which means she had no husband. And we're also told that he is the only son. So she's without a husband and without a son. Did she have daughters? Did she still have a father and mother living? We don't know that. But in this day, a woman left without a father, a husband, or a son would have been in danger of destitution. There was no social safety net. She would be completely reliant upon relatives or neighbors for her survival. Any death is tragic. This death had layers of tragedy to it. That's what Luke tells us. What happens? And when the Lord saw her, verse 13, he had compassion on her and said to her, "Do not weep." Many of the miracles that Jesus performs occur because someone comes and makes a request of Jesus for the miracle. Or they bring someone to Jesus. There is some kind of appeal made to Jesus. Sometimes even from a distance. That was the case with the centurion servant at the beginning of the chapter. In the two other occasions, besides this one, where Jesus raises a dead person, a request was made of him to intervene while the person was dying, and that would be Jairus' daughter and Lazarus. Jesus here acts without being prompted. There is no request made of him. But there is something that does prompt his action. When the Lord saw her, he had compassion on her. That expression there in the original, "he had compassion," some translations say he felt for her. It literally means to have the bowels yearn. Now, lest you misunderstand, this has nothing to do with a gastrointestinal issue. But to have your bowels yearn, that's something the ancients would say regarding their inner person. Their inner person was agitated, moved, stirred. Another way of saying this, when Jesus saw her, his heart went out to her. or his heart was broken for her. He saw her, he felt for her, and then he said, "Don't weep." At this moment, to this woman, that's like telling grass not to be green. What could she but do except weep? She's carrying her only son to the grave, and she was a widow. And it's not one of those moments where Jesus is saying, now, don't cry, everything's going to be okay, that we sometimes express to people when we have no power to make it okay and we have no knowledge that it's going to be okay. Even the most insensitive person would probably not say that to this woman at this time. Oh, it's going to be okay. No, he said this because he's about to remove her reason for weeping. And he does so in verse 14. Then he came up and touched the bear, and the bearer stood still. And he said, "Young man, I say to you, arise." To touch a dead body in Jewish society shaped by the Levitical law would mean that you would be ceremonially unclean, which meant that you would be prohibited from participating in certain religious rituals if you touched a dead body. But people had to touch dead bodies, taking care of their relatives that passed. And so if you did that, you had to go through a waiting period of your uncleanness, and you would have to go through ceremonial washings. And so generally, you avoided that unless you had to. If you had to take care of a dead body, you did, but typically you avoided that. Jesus goes right over and touches his body. Luke tells us the bearers stood still. These little details are mighty. They're carrying the body. Jesus comes up and he touches it and they stop. But were they frightened? Were they offended that this man had interrupted their funeral procession? Are they frozen and shocked that he would just come up and touch a dead body? It just drives home the drama of the moment. This is a tense moment when he comes up and he touches the body. And what Jesus demonstrates here is that he is totally unique. By touching the dead body, Jesus does not become contaminated, because with Jesus' touch, the death is driven away. And so it is with touching a leper or anyone who is diseased. Jesus was not contaminated, but rather Jesus imparted purification and healing, wholeness, and in this case, life. "Young man, I say to you, rise." There were two great miracle-working prophets in the Old Testament in the divided kingdom period, and that's Elijah and Elisha. Did you know that both Elijah and Elisha resurrected only sons? By the way, in case you didn't know it, resurrecting the dead is not commonplace even in the Bible. It's a very unusual thing, even in the Bible. But Elijah and Elisha did it for boys who were the only sons of their mothers. And there's a connection that Elijah and Elisha have with those mothers in those texts in 1 Kings and in 2 Kings. Just like Jesus has a connection because he has compassion on this woman. And when Elijah and Elisha raised a young boy from the dead, it was with elaborate physical actions. It's the only time they do it in their ministries, even though they did other miracles and they were great prophets. There were elaborate physical actions involved, and it was a process. And even one of them cried out to God and begged to God, Jesus. Jesus just steps up, touches the body and says, "Young man, I say to you, arise." That's all it took. Calling from this world through portals unseen and unknown by us, to where this soul resided, Jesus called and brought him back to this world, to his body, and to his mother. That's power. Verse 15. And the dead man sat up and began to speak. And Jesus gave him to his mother. Wow, what an expression. The dead man sat up and began to speak. What a gasp there must have been when he sat up and began to speak. What a reaction there must have been. We'll see the reaction in just a moment. What did he say? We don't know. We don't know what he said. He said something. I don't know what he said. If he was a jokester, he probably cracked a joke. I don't know. Did he give praise to God? Did he say, hello, mother? We don't know what he said. But he woke up and he spoke, showing that he was very much alive. He's back. And Jesus gave him to his mother? How did that work? Is that like a symbolic statement that he's resurrected him, thus he's given back to his mother? Or literally, they lower the man. He steps off this litter he's being carried on. This is an open contraption that he's being carried on, by the way, whatever it is. That he actually takes the man and hands him to his mother, like walks him over, or I don't know, but it does say he gave him to his mother. Wow. Have you ever seen a reunion like that? Imagine now what she felt. Imagine what she thought of Jesus. Everyone else was affected too. Verse 16, fear seized them all, and they glorified God, saying, a great prophet has arisen among us. Possibly in their minds, they're thinking of Elijah and Elisha, because Elijah and Elisha did things like this. And God has visited his people. And this report about him spread through the whole of Judea and all the surrounding country. Of course it would. It says there in verse 16 that fear seized them all, both crowds, both the crowd coming in with Jesus to Nain, the crowd coming out of Nain to take this young man to his burial site. Fear seized them all. Some translations say they were gripped with fear. Unusual reversal. To some extent, there is something about death that is fearful. There is some experience of fear that the person dying has, you see it. The person around the person, they experience this, whatever fear is, uncertainty, unnerved, troubled, anxious, all the kinds of things we think about with fear, even though we may have faith and confidence in the person's faith in Christ and their devotion to Christ, and we know they're passing on to sleep in Jesus until the resurrection, and we're comforted by that, but death is still a hard thing, and it is still a fearful thing, is we're staring our great enemy right smack in the face. And there are all kinds of other things associated with that. Some people have fear of funeral homes and caskets and graves, graveyards and things like that. And being around a deceased body. But this, people are gripped with fear. People are seized with fear, not because life has left a body and someone is dead, but rather life has returned to a body and they're no longer dead. Now they're fearful. It's like an even greater fear. All of them had been connected to the other kind of fear. They'd seen people die before and experienced that. But this one, this is a whole new kind of fear. They've seen life come into a body. And I would dare say that if we saw the same thing, we'd be gripped with fear as well. And then they have the right reaction and the right conclusion. A great prophet has risen among us. God has visited his people. And they glorify God. They're on the right track. How could you not make this conclusion if you witness such an event? Wow. The raising of the son of the widow of Nain. What do you see when you see the dead rise and speak? Because Jesus said, rise up and speak. What do you see? What do you see when you see Jesus? Well, we see that life is in Jesus the Christ. I was in a funeral Friday night. I spoke at a funeral Friday night. And Lori and we were at the gravesite yesterday. And I tell you, that's just when all the props get knocked out, it's real. And you've been at funerals, and you've been in funeral processions, and you've walked to a gravesite as a body was carried. And of course, the closer you are to the person who died, the heavier the experience is, or the closer you are to those who are left, the heavier the experience is. And I've been involved in a lot of funeral processions, and there have been places where I've lived where they have a custom where the preacher rides in the hearse. And I've done that many times. And in the next of the last funeral I did, a few weeks ago, they had me ride in my car behind the hearse. And I don't know if there's hardly been a time over the last 30 years or so that when I was in one of those moments, I didn't think it looked so. And the widow of Nain. And I envision that someone stops that funeral procession and they walk up and they have the casket opened and they touch that body and that dead person sets up and speaks. I mean, that is something to envision. And what if you saw that? What if you saw that happen to someone who's died and the person who's left behind or people left behind you're very, very close to, you have compassion for them. Or it's someone that you knew so very well. Well, I've never seen it happen outside of Luke 7. And I venture to say you haven't either. And it would be easy to say, well, this is all too outlandish to be true. It is outlandish. All right, you know what that word means, right? Outlandish. The very end of where people live. That's like where I'm from. Asheville's a big fancy place compared to where I'm from. Where I'm from, it was not the end of the earth, but you could see it from the back porch. Something extreme and on the edge. This is. And one question would be, it's too outlandish to believe. But here's another question. Isn't it so outlandish that you got to make sure it's not true? Because if it is true and you've missed it, you've missed everything. You've missed the most important thing. If the power of life is in Jesus, knowing him is the most important thing. And he promises that one day he'll speak just like he spoke here. And everyone will come out of the grave. We see that Jesus restores. Certainly she would have felt it, but in many realistic ways, this woman lost everything when she lost her son. But through Jesus, he was restored. What's missing in your life? What's broken in your life? What's lost in your life? I suppose it'd be like fingerprints. All very different, all very unique. Christ does not promise to fix everything in your life. He doesn't promise to restore every lost piece. You see, he didn't stop and raise the dead of every funeral procession in Galilee. Nor in Palestine, nor in the Roman Empire or the world. There were other people who died. There were other mothers who carried their sons or sons who carried their mothers to the grave. But Jesus didn't do that for all. He didn't heal all the blind people and all the paralyzed people and all the sick people. He did do it to demonstrate who he is. That Christ is the restorer. That he has the power and the willingness to restore us. The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. He makes me to lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside the still waters. He restores my soul. Psalm 23. Don't fixate on what Jesus will restore. Don't expect a specific thing you won't fix to be fixed. Or in a way that you want it fixed, or on a timetable in which you want it restored. The widow that day, what would have been her hopes? Realistically, what would she have wanted to come from that day that would be the best possible outcome? Maybe comfort from friends. Maybe a friend that she hadn't seen in a long time, or a friend with whom she was estranged and she longed to be connected to, and the friend came and they restored their relationship. Maybe a distant relative to come up and say, "You're going to come live with us." Or her neighbors coming up and saying, "We pooled our resources and we're going to make sure that you have what you need to stay where you're living, and we're going to take care of you and we're going to assure you of that." Those kinds of things. Maybe she never expected that her son would wake up and speak to her and be presented to her. She never expected that. That's what she got. Regardless of what changes or doesn't change in our circumstances, do you believe that Christ can restore, can heal, can give life to your soul? That's what we're called to believe. And when he does restore our soul, we'll be blessed in ways we can never imagine and we would never think to ask. That's what you see when you see Jesus. Jesus says to her, "Don't weep." In a way, Jesus is asking her to do something which would be against the whole moment and her inclination in that situation. He tells this widowed mother to not weep. But what else would she do in this unless she had reason to do otherwise? This is not predicated on him raising the son, but it's there. It's an illustration to us. Look at the sequence of things. It's very fascinating. Instead of going over and raising this young man and presenting him to the mother and then saying, "Now don't weep," which would make complete sense, right? Matter of fact, if he went over and spoke to the man and raised the man and brought him over to the mother, he wouldn't even have to say, "Don't weep." She'd stop her weeping. She may have tears, but they'd be tears of joy. It'd be a completely kind of different emotion. That's not how he does it. He does it sort of backward. He says, "Don't weep." She had no reason to stop weeping except the word of Christ. Luke doesn't tell us exactly how she responded. That's not the point. But Jesus does, in many ways, ask the same of us. Jesus has done so much to cause us to believe in him way before we were even born. Jesus does so many things. He's proven himself to be true. But it's also important that we understand that he does in some ways ask us to accept his word and to trust it and to put faith in his word before he does the thing he's promised he will do. For instance, our resurrection. Jesus has promised to resurrect us even before we die. Do we believe that? And when you look at Jesus, we see that he sees us. Verse 13. "And when the Lord saw her, he had compassion on her." One of the most important things you can see about Jesus is that he sees you. We have to work and learn to see Jesus. Jesus has always seen us. From the moment of our conception to our birth, to our childhood, through all those years, all that we've done, all that we've experienced, all that's happened to us, all that people have done to us and for us and against us and with us or whatever, Jesus has seen us. He's seen us all the time. Because where is he now? The Bible teaches that he ascended back to heaven after his resurrection. And he sat down at the right hand of God. And he is ruling there as King Supreme. He has left behind his word to guide us. He has left behind informing his church to give us comfort and direction and encouragement and support. He works in his providence to care for us and provide for us and especially to lead us to the Father. You see that Jesus sees you. And that he has compassion. Jesus' heart goes out to you. His heart breaks for you. That's who Jesus is. And that childless widow, sonless widow, shall we say, to be exactly accurate, she was feeling the chilly and uncertain clutches of loneliness engulf her. She started her descent into it. She was sinking. And then Jesus saw her. Will you see Jesus seeing you and feeling for you and extending his heart to you? And that is one way he is our heroic Savior. And though from Hercules to Superman, those narratives may reveal so much about what we're longing for, but it's in Jesus we find what we're looking for, what we must have. And only Jesus is the superhero, because he sees and he saves. And he's willing to do that for anybody. How interesting it is that some of the more dramatic moments, wow, it's hard to pick from them, but some of the more dramatic moments in the ministry of Jesus had to do with resurrecting the dead. And definitely a pitch point of the Gospels is, and of the Bible, and of all human history, is the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus. Wow, no wonder it is centrally located and put at a peak. And today, Christ, for those who see him, calls for any lost soul who is sinking into death to die with him, be buried, and be resurrected. For in Romans chapter 6, we're told that we can be buried into his death and raised to walk in newness of life. That's for those who see Jesus, those who believe that Jesus is the Christ, who can restore even life and allows themselves to die with him and be raised with him so they can live with him in restoration forever. That invitation is always open to any soul who wants to respond. And you can even do that this morning as we close by singing this last song with Brother Dave.